It please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Arvin, registration number 39020, representing Mr. Matthew O'Neill. Today I plan to discuss primarily the first issue raised in Mr. O'Neill's briefs, and that is the issue of the legislative intent behind the definition of a firearm under section 18.1901. I might also touch on the second issue, the constitutional vagueness issue. I do not plan on discussing the third and fourth issues. However, if this court has any questions concerning those issues, I'll be happy to take the court's questions.
Counsel, I have a question on your first issue that you're about to talk about, and it's a question I want to address to the people as well when they get a chance. Why isn't a pistol a per se firearm without regard to whoever's intended to be capable of discharging a bullets? Why isn't a pistol just a per se firearm under the structure of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, first, the way the statute is written, I believe that pistol connects to the word capable of discharging bullets, as well as the language or intended to be capable of discharging bullets.
I thought that was the last category, or other instrument, capable or intended to be capable of discharging bullets. I thought pistol was a few clauses before then, or a few words with commas before then.
That is correct, Your Honor. There are words with commas preceding that. However, I would submit that in reading the statute, a plain language reading of the statute suggests that pistol connects to the language stating that it must be capable of discharging bullets or the projectiles, as well as the intent portion of the statute. I would further suggest that if we look at People v. Vigil, a case where the Supreme Court dealt with a non-functional weapon, the court determined that the defendant's that the non-functional weapon was not per se a weapon. The non-functional weapon was only a weapon if it could be repaired by a quickly effected repair, which in that case took 2 seconds. Otherwise, the court implied that the defendant had to intend for the weapon to be functional.
Was V. Hill dealing with the same definition of firearm that we are here?
Not precisely, Your Honor. V. Hill was dealing with the dangerous weapon statute, which is similar. I would suggest the legislative intent behind the dangerous weapon statute is similar to the firearm statute that we have here. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, isn't like a qualifier dangerous weapon? Maybe that indicates why something should either be operable or readily operable. Versus we don't have dangerous firearm, we just have you possess a firearm or other weapon.
Well, the dangerous weapon statute deals with firearms that are the legislature determined to be actually more dangerous than a typical firearm. For example, a sawed-off shotgun or a weapon with a silencer. It seems to me that if the legislature determined that in dealing with weapons that are more dangerous than a typical firearm, that the weapon had to be usable in some manner or usable with a quickly effective repair, then that same intent would apply to firearms that are less dangerous than the sort of weapons described in the dangerous firearm statute.
Counsel, I thank you for your time addressing this issue. Please proceed.
Thank you. The trial court, as this court knows, interpreted section 18.1901 and concluded that concerning that intent element that we were discussing, that the manufacturer's intent was determinative. For several reasons, this could not have been the legislature's intent. First, it is presumed that in enacting legislation, the General Assembly intends statutes to conform to constitutional requirements. Our courts have determined that a law that leaves the defendant's guilt in the unfettered discretion of a third party or holds a defendant culpable for the mental state of a third party violates due process and equal protection. In People v. Vignola, for example, our Supreme Court addressed a law that criminalized the passing of bad checks. There, the court determined that under that law, the defendant's guilt rested on the unfettered discretion of a third party, that is the bank, because it was up to the bank as to whether or not to honor the check. The Supreme Court determined that because two people can commit the same act, presenting a bad check, but one would escape liability and the other would not, depending on the bank's discretion, the law violated equal protection and due process.
Was that dependent upon a third party's intent after the defendant's conduct was complete?
It is, Your Honor. In Vanola, that is the case.
And in this case, that would not be the case, though, would it? Because in this case, it would be knowingly possessing a weapon which the manufacturer may have already intended to be capable of discharge. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, I would suggest that the holding of Vanola is still important here. Regardless of when the manufacturer forms his or her intent, that intent determines whether or not a defendant is convicted under the trial court's interpretation.
Well, counsel, do we have legislative history one way or the other on this point, on this statute?
No, Your Honor. I attempted to look into legislative history regarding 18-1901-3H. When the law was passed, this portion of the law, the legislature did not record its history on audio, so I wasn't able to obtain audio recordings.
Well, are you able to attain what the purpose of the statute is then, even without the legislative history?
Well, of course, 18-1901-3H simply defines what a firearm is, and it's a subsection that's referred to by other statutes.
As it pertains to previous offenders, what's the purpose of the statute?
I did not look into the legislative history of that statute. I would speculate that the legislative intent behind that statute is to prevent previous felons from possessing a weapon if they intend for that weapon to be functional, if they intend for that weapon to be functional so they can use it in a crime and hurt themselves or hurt someone else.
Well, you say that it intend to be functional. What about a show of force, for instance? Wouldn't the purpose be to deter a show of force, whether it was real or apparent?
In other words, if the defendant intended to deter a show of force from someone else?
If they pull out a gun, but the other person doesn't know that it's real or not, or it works or not, I guess maybe the best way to put it, isn't the purpose of the statute to deter that as well?
Perhaps, Your Honor, perhaps. If that is a legislative intent, then I would suggest that the intent element in 18-1901-3H still requires that the defendant's intent is determinative here. Because under the trial court's interpretation of 18-1901-3H, the defendant's intent towards the gun has no bearing whatsoever. Under the trial court's interpretation, it's irrelevant if the defendant even knew that someone else intended for the gun to work. So if the legislative intent is that it's to prohibit defendants from, previous felons from possessing firearms and prohibiting them from possessing them because they're not using them as a show of force, I'd suggest there's still some intent element necessary there, or at least a knowledge element that the weapon can be used to intimidate another party or something to that effect.
Mr. Arvin, we have a division of this court that decided this issue under the same statute, whether it's the defendant's intent or someone else's intent, in People versus Atencio. It's a 1994 Colorado Court of Appeals case, and it came down on the other side from the one you're advocating. It says it was not necessary for the prosecution to show that the defendant intended to use it as a deadly weapon. And it cites People versus Loomis also. Firearms, knives, and bludgeons are per se capable of producing death or serious bodily injury in the manner they are used or intended to be used. How would you have us deal with this precedent from another division of our court?
If I'm not mistaken, Atencio deals with the deadly weapon statute, not the definition of a firearm under that we're considering here. And the firearm, the definition of a firearm has the word intent within it. So there's no dispute that someone's intent is dispositive here. For the constitutional reasons that I've mentioned, it has to be, well, in order to satisfy the Constitution, I should say, the defendant's intent is required to be considered by the jury.
Are you arguing the doctrine of transferred intent?
You could construe the trial court's interpretation of 18-1901 as transferred intent, yes. The manufacturer's intent, the defendant is effectively penalized for the manufacturer's intent. I would also point out in People v. Tenorio, our Supreme Court analyzed the possession of weapon by a previous offender statute, and it analyzed a separate but related provision of that statute. Under the statute, it states that a defendant cannot knowingly possess a weapon, the defendant cannot knowingly possess a firearm or any other weapon. The Tenorio court analyzed what was required to hold the defendant liable for possessing any other weapon under that statute. And it stated that some mental culpability is required on the part of the defendant. In other words, the defendant must understand that the object in his possession is a weapon.
Didn't either in Tenorio or in Gross, they talk about, well, that's right, that applies for weapons who weren't designed to be weapons. Did they mention that? I thought in Tenorio or Gross they might have mentioned, well, this is the test to apply when you're dealing with something that wasn't designed to be a weapon.
I don't remember that, but I certainly wouldn't dispute that characterization, Your Honor.
My memory may be going, counsel.
Sometimes I'm afraid that mine is too. But regardless, Tenorio applies to an object that is not in its current state of a weapon. Just like the non-functioning pistol that we have here. So I would suggest that Tenorio instructs us that when we're dealing with the sort of object we have here, a completely non-functional weapon, then there must be some kind of mental culpability. And I would suggest that if the legislature put that directly in the definition of a firearm when it stated that it must be intended to discharge bullets. Are intended to be capable of discharging bullets, excuse me. Unless this court has any further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
I do have one question.
Okay.
And it relates back to the very first issue that I raised with you, counsel, about can you have pistols and automatics themselves, their own categories, and then have this other thing, other instruments capable or intended to be capable of discharging bullets.
Could we stop Let's the stop the clock. Thank you.
Because my question is taking up much longer than your time for your answer.
No problem.
But if we had these different clauses and then we had or other instruments capable or intended to be capable, could it be meant to apply to things which the defendant has created and therefore made capable or intended to be capable of discharging bullets? In other words, could this clause be consistent with your theory that it has to be defendant's intent? But it's only for homemade guns, homemade types of things that the defendant was trying to make.
No, Your Honor, and I would suggest that if you look at Tenorio, which in analogous circumstances, the Supreme Court determined that the defendant must have some cognizance that what he possesses is a weapon or can be used as a weapon. That suggests that the legislature did not intend to punish a defendant for simply possessing a firearm. The firearm has to be either capable or intended to be capable of projecting bullets. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a little less than 2 minutes remaining, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Roger Bellotti. My registration number is 16782. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Colorado, and I represent the people in this matter. And wanted to take up your honor's question. If you could repeat what you originally said to counsel so I make sure I'm on the same page.
Why isn't a pistol a per se firearm without regard to whoever's intent that it be capable or intended to be capable of discharging a bullet? Why isn't it a per se firearm?
That would be an interpretation to my advantage, but...
I know. I'm wondering why you didn't make it.
Right, and here's why. Because you start with possession of firearms as described in Section 18.1.901.3H. Go down to that section. Any handgun, automatic, revolver, pistol, rifle, shotgun, or other instrument or device capable or intended to be capable of discharging bullets, cartridges, or other explosive charges. Now, trying to give a reasonable reading of these two statutes and what the legislature reasonably intended here. Arguably, it doesn't refer us to individual definitions of handgun, automatic, revolver, pistol, rifle, or shotgun. Now, a pistol, would that include a water pistol? Is that what the legislature was getting at also? What about a toy rifle or a toy pistol or a toy revolver, a cap gun?
What about the lack of qualifiers for those? When it says pistol, you think in the general population's mind, they think of toy pistols?
It's to avoid any confusion, I think, is what they were getting at, was we want firearms, and they refer back to firearms.
Let's look to the comparable deadly weapons statute. And what did it say in deadly weapons originally? Didn't it say firearms and knives?
Mm-hmm.
Was the Supreme Court worried in those cases about toy firearms or toy knives?
Well, it said firearms, so, and I'm not sure what they referred back, if they gave a definition of firearms to another statute. That would
okay.
be my question.
Thank you, Counsel.
Okay. Now, the defendant here was charged with possession of a weapon by a previous offender, and at his trial, his position was he did not intend for the handgun to be capable of discharging ammunition, and he did not know the manufacturer intended the handgun to be capable of discharging ammunition. So during the trial, he makes a motion to dismiss. And he argues that the prosecution had to prove that he possessed an operable firearm, or in the alternative, that he had the intent to make it operable. The defense claims the manufacturer's intent to manufacture an operable firearm is not at issue. And it's not at issue because a third party's intent is not relevant in a criminal prosecution. And the court also rejected later in the trial three tendered defense theory of the case instructions that were premised and based on this statutory interpretation that the defendant was putting forward. Now, 18.12.108.3, that prohibits a previous offender from knowingly possessing a firearm. And then that statute refers us down to 18.1.901.3H, which defines firearm in relevant part, and I'm paraphrasing now, any handgun capable or intended to be capable of discharging ammunition. Now, the required mental state of possession by a previous offender is knowingly. And what the previous offender cannot knowingly possess is a firearm that is capable, or in this case, was intended to be capable, of discharging ammunition.
Intended by whom? The statute doesn't say.
Intended, if it was intended by the person that made it. If that was the manufacturer.
Where do we glean that intent from?
That's a reasonable reading of the statute.
Is there another reasonable reading of that statute, such as intended by the defendant to
Certainly.
Be operable?
If he manufactured his own, let's say in Afghanistan, they can go in. You can go into shops and make your own AK-47s.
No, we're not
That's
talking
a weapon.
About whether the defendant manufactured himself. The defendant may have had a handgun.
Right.
And did he intend it to be operable? Why isn't that a reasonable reading of the statute, or as reasonable a reading of the statute as the one that, no, is intended by its maker, by the manufacturer? Why?
Well, let me back up just a little bit. Let me explain. What I would argue is the legislature's intent of the statutes in question is that they don't want previous offenders to possess handguns that were manufactured to be operable, but at the same time, the offender possessed it, it had some defect that rendered it temporarily inoperable. So in this specific case with these facts, he's got a gun which the evidence shows was manufactured
was intended to be a gun capable of discharging ammunition. But at the time he possessed it, it was inoperable. It couldn't discharge ammunition.
Counsel, I understand it, but you still haven't answered me why your construction is preferable to it's the defendant's intent that matters. I understand how your construction would apply to the facts here, but you haven't answered why your construction about, no, it's got to be the manufacturer's intent, is preferable to why it couldn't be the defendant's intent.
Couldn't be the defendant's, that he knew it was intended to be manufactured?
The handgun was capable or intended by the defendant to be capable of discharging weapons. Why is firearm or handgun capable or intended by the manufacturer preferable to intended by the defendant to be capable?
Because it would go against the legislative intent.
Where is that evident, counsel?
That's evident in the reading of the statute, because what they want to avoid, again, is offenders having operable handguns and guns that were manufactured to be firearms, but at the moment he possesses it, is inoperable.
Where do we glean that from the language of the statute?
Because you want to avoid people claiming when they are found in violation, well, just as he claims here, it's inoperable and I never intended it to be operable. That's the legislature, that's not what they intended, that it be operable at the moment he possessed it or that he intended it to be inoperable, because they wanted to keep that gun out of his hands. Because at later on, he may want to make it operable, and he can also use, the offender can use the firearm to intimidate somebody or use it in a robbery or whatever, because you have situations where people can threaten people, they think it's an operable firearm. That's what they're trying to avoid here.
Counsel, I asked your counterpart something similar related to the intent or the purpose of the statute, and I was talking about a show of force, you may recall that.
Yes.
But I never did pin him down on a specific point or section of the statute, and that's what I think my colleague is asking you to do now. Can you identify the statutory section that reveals the legislative intent that you're describing to us?
Well, intent is, you get intent from a reasonable reading of the statute.
So which portion of the statute?
You go to the plain language, okay?
Which language?
The language that says, handguns that were manufactured to be operable, but at the same time, was intended to be capable of discharging ammunition. What that goes to, you're describing the object he's prohibited from possessing. Okay? What you're saying is you can't possess this kind of object. It's not intent in the sense that I intended it, the defendant intended something. But this is the kind of object we have here. This was an object manufactured for the purpose of discharging ammunition. That's the intention of this object, or that's why it was manufactured. So you're not trying to discern a mens rea here. But you can look at the object and you can discern, was this made to be a gun? Just as you can look at something, was this made to be a car, with the intent that it be operated and driven on the roads? Was this manufactured for this other purpose? A reasonable person can look at it and discern what it was made for. And that's what this is going to. It's describing the object that the previous offender cannot possess. In other words, you can't go out and possess a handgun, or let me say that, a rifle, let's say, a bolt-action rifle. It doesn't have a bolt in it. You can take out the bolt, all right? Can't possess that.
Well,
it's still a firearm.
Well, let's suggest the alternative construction, and that is that, it would only be a firearm if it was intended to be capable of discharging a bullet. What would be unreasonable about applying it in that sense, because the firearm is not dangerous anymore? The fact that a felon has a firearm that can't affect any injury, why would that be an unreasonable application of the statute?
Because they want to avoid situations, one, where they can make it operable, all right? In my example, if he doesn't have, if he has the bolt action rifle without the bolt, he can go to the gunsmith and get a bolt for it.
Was there any evidence in this case that it was, it could have easily been fixed?
There was evidence by his own witness, I believe, Brandon, who said that you'd have to go to a gunsmith
and have it disassembled and then put back together again.
Correct.
It doesn't seem to a novice in guns to suggest that it's easily repairable.
It doesn't say anything about being easily repairable in this statute, though, and that's, I'm not reading that in here. In some statutes in other states, that may well be in there, that is readily repairable, but that's not what this statute is saying.
And I'm not, I guess I'm trying to say, you're giving a purpose for the statute contrary to another purpose that I think is suggested, that no, this statute's only meant to get things that are dangerous, things that the defendant could use in a dangerous manner.
Right.
And I think the application that they're suggesting is this isn't dangerous. It can't shoot.
But it is capable of being made to shoot. It has that ability. It has not lost its character as a firearm. And that's crucial here. It's not like he just possesses a trigger or a barrel. Then he's got a better argument that this has lost its character as a firearm. And there's testimony here that the grips aren't on, but we still got a handle. We still got a 9mm semi-automatic that can be loaded. It's got a defective firing pin from what the evidence tells us. But it still meets this statutory definition. It was intended to be a firearm. And he, in effect, testified to that himself because he said it doesn't work. And what you can take from that is if it doesn't work, I mean, it doesn't discharge ammunition. But again, the legislative intent here, reasonable interpretation, is that they want to keep that type of thing out of the hand of a previous offender. That's still a firearm as they're defining it in this statute. And that's what they're trying to prevent. So you're avoiding the situation where defendants are coming in and saying, it doesn't work, there's no the safety doesn't work or whatever, it's inoperable, therefore I don't possess a firearm. Well, they're including within this statute to include that type of thing. They want that, the legislature wants that included. And the reason is obvious, that it's capable of being repaired or that it's been able to use to intimidate or make people think it is a real firearm. Court have any other questions? Okay, that's all I have today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bilotti. Your rebuttal, counsel?
I would just again point out that in People v. Vigil, our Supreme Court considered a non-functional weapon. And under the dangerous weapon statute, not under this statute, which arguably has a higher threshold in order to make it a punishable crime due to the intent element. But in Vigil, the Supreme Court did consider an inoperable weapon and stated that the weapon only fell within the statute's ambit if it could be repaired with a quickly effected repair, which was demonstrated in that case in a 2-second repair, replacing the firing pin, and then I believe the firing pin was leveled out, which took like 20 seconds. The facts here are far from the facts in Vigil. The state investigator stated that replacement parts would have to be ordered in order to fix the weapon in question, the object in question. I'd also point out that the jury did not consider whether or not the weapon could be fixed within a reasonable or a quick period of time, because the prosecution instructed the jury that what is dispositive under 18-1901 is whether or not the manufacturer intended for the pistol to work. So the jury considered whether or not the manufacturer intended for this pistol to work. It did not necessarily consider whether or not the pistol could be repaired within a quick period of time. Finally, I would just point out that under the rule of lenity, courts are required to construe statutes in favor of the accused. I believe that the correct interpretation of 18-1901H is that the intendant's intent is determinative. However, if it is not, I would suggest the rule of lenity requires this court to find, to make that finding given the ambiguity of the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Arvin. Thank you both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.